101 days into the U.S.-Israel genocide in the Gaza Strip, and the death toll is 24,100. Despite over 3 months of killing and destruction of Palestinians, Israel has failed to achieve any of its declared objectives in removing Hamas or releasing captives. Israeli occupation forces raid several areas in the West Bank, killing at least 5 Palestinians and detaining dozens more. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Sanjefi. Good to have you with us. Israel is pushing ahead with its deadly campaign of bombings and raids in the Gaza Strip. That's 101 days into the onslaught. The latest attacks have claimed the lives of at least 45 more Palestinians in Gaza. 33 civilians were killed in a raid on residential buildings in the early hours of Monday. Another 12 were killed in an attack in eastern Gaza. Death toll from the Israeli genocide has already surpassed the 24,000 mark. Also, the civilian infrastructure in Gaza has sustained extensive damage as a result of relentless bombings and shelling. Latest figures indicating some 100 schools and universities, more than 140 mosques in Gaza have been totally destroyed. And that's in addition to more than 80 hospitals and health centers that are already out of service. The military wing of the Islamic Jihad has released new footage that shows targeting and killing an Israeli trooper in the besieged Gaza Strip. The video shows an Al-Quds Brigade sniper shooting the trooper in Khan Yunus, south of the Strip. The regime is yet to confirm the incident. The military wing of Hamas movement also says its fighters targeted Israeli occupation forces in Khan Yunus with mortar shells. According to Al-Qassam Brigades, the attack left a number of casualties. Israel has admitted the death of nearly 190 of its troopers in Gaza since the beginning of the regime's ground invasion there. Resistance groups in the territory say that Israel is under-reporting its casualties. According to Israeli media, some 4,000 forces have also suffered disabilities since October 7. Now, Charlotte Gates, who is with the Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, says that Israel has been unable to achieve its announced goals in Gaza.
The occupation has been unable to break the will of the Palestinian people or destroy the resistance. It has also taken a tremendous human cost from people because the occupation's attacks have been directed against the civilian population as a whole. They've targeted hospitals, schools, residential buildings, mosques, churches. I mean, the purpose of the occupation's attacks, and they're very explicit about this. And this, of course, was also brought up before the International Court of Justice in just the past several days in South Africa's case, is that the purpose of these attacks was to cause the greatest damage possible to the Palestinian civilian population. And unfortunately, this comes as no surprise because this has always been the purpose and the goal of the Zionist movement and the Zionist entity in occupied Palestine since 1948 and before. And we're seeing them continue to attempt to carry out the same project of dispossession, displacement, targeting the Palestinian people as a whole that they have been doing for over 75 years with the full support and complicity of the United States, Canada, Germany, Britain, and other European powers, all of which are fully responsible and must be held accountable for this ongoing genocide.
Reports of Israeli forces stealing money from the Palestinian homes that the raid in the West Bank have added a new dimension to the atrocities the regime is committing against Palestinians. Palestinian media has released new footage that shows Israeli troopers stealing cash. The video is made in a residential building in Ramallah. Since October 7, similar footage of Israeli forces stealing Palestinian property have been released on several occasions. And these are in addition to reports by Palestinians on the theft of their money, gold, and other valuables by Israeli troopers. The reports have triggered warnings by rights groups of systematic theft in civilian homes in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Lebanese resistance movement says that it's conducted new strikes against Israeli military targets. Hezbollah says that the operations have inflicted losses on the Israeli regime forces stationed south of the Lebanese border. Our correspondent Mariam Salana joins us for more on that. Let's go to Maryam and see what she has for us. What's the latest, Maryam?
Well, you mentioned that they have declared, of course, and announced in many statements that they have attacked and targeted the Israeli posts in several areas. Of course, some of these posts, we've heard their names before. We've basically memorized them. But what is new is that it seems that the resistance every time has a something else or something new that is being targeted. But of course, in two instances, for example, in Mitat and Ramim, they targeted soldiers directly. And those soldiers are not always situated inside the barracks. Sometimes they're surrounding the barracks somewhere near, trying to find places where they can hide or moving from one place to another. But still, the resistance has been capable of directly targeting and hitting scores, basically. And that we know from the statements, they say that they have definitely inflicted casualties on the Israeli soldiers in both Mitat and Ramim. We also have two other significant operations. We have, for example, in Birkat Risha, one instance they targeted the post, then later on they targeted it with a Burkan rocket, which is a very highly, if we may say, sophisticated type of rocket, since it is a very medium range. It is actually a short range rocket, which has very strong capabilities, and they use that in several instances. Of course, Hezbollah, they have only introduced it in this confrontation, and it seems that Hezbollah use it when they want to basically cause and inflict specific destruction in certain barracks for the Israelis. We had that in Birkat Rishi in one of the instances. You also have in the Motuli area, they did not only just target the post, they targeted newly situated and set espionage devices. As you know, Hezbollah has made sure to target all the devices that are used for espionage, that are used to spy on all of Lebanon and beyond Lebanon, in addition to anything that is being used to eavesdrop and even interfere with the radio frequencies and so on. They have targeted that in the surrounding of Tully, since the Israelis seem to be putting and setting forth new devices every now and then, and then in addition to the use of their drones, which are used also for reconnaissance. And so every time there is a new device, we notice how Hezbollah is quick to make sure that they have turned that off, making sure that they have blinded the Israeli capabilities when it comes to those posts. Of course, in Malkiya and Asumaka, in the occupied Shabah farms as well, they have also targeted those posts. Now, that also came simultaneously with continuous Israeli shelling on several of the Lebanese towns, and here we're talking about the towns that are situated right at the border and also those that are a bit further off. Yesterday, we had the first instance of an attack, which was near the towns of Siddiqin and Qana. That was going a bit further in areas which are considered closer to Tyre. That is the city that is considered relatively safe. It has not been targeted so far. And so, therefore, that is a very a dangerous development, we can say. But fortunately, it did not cause human casualties. There was some destruction in the houses as a result of the pressure that was enforced by that shelling, since it wasn't an area which was an open area. It was more like in the outskirts of the two villages in between. And so, therefore, that did not cause direct human casualties.
Thanks for that, Maryam Saleh, our correspondent in Lebanon. Now, moving on, the leader of Lebanon's resistance movement has stressed Hezbollah's preparedness to confront Israel in case of an attack by the regime.
We've been ready for war. We're not afraid of war. We don't fear war. We won't hesitate in such a war. And we will go to such a war. And as I said, we will fight without any constraints, without any ceiling, without any limit, boundaries.
Status on Nasrallah said that Israel has been trying to cover up its failures in Gaza. After 100 days of onslaught, Israel has failed to achieve its goals. He hailed the Palestinian resistance for dealing heavy blows to the Israeli military. Nasrallah said that Tel Aviv undercounts its casualties due to pressure from the public. He said that Israelis have acknowledged that the regime's military is caught in a quagmire in Gaza, and they're calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Israeli forces have killed more Palestinians during fresh raids in the occupied West Bank. The troopers shot a teenager in the chest at a refugee camp near the city of Ariha or Jericho. Two Palestinian teens were also killed in an area near Ramallah. The other killings took place near the city of Al-Khalil, where the regime's military fatally shot two Palestinian youths. Two others, including a woman, were killed in the town of Dora, southwest of Al-Khalil. Israeli forces also raided a university in Annapolis, abducting 25 students. Israel has intensified deadly raids across the West Bank since the beginning of its genocidal war on Gaza. Over the past 100 days, more than 340 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. In the same period, the regime's also abducted hundreds of people. Now, our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kandil joined us a while ago and told us about the latest Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank.
Every day, the Israelis are raiding Palestinian areas. They are storming Palestinian areas. As you have said, the Israeli military raided the city of Nablus, and they, let's say, stormed the University of An-Najah. Dozens of Palestinians had been protesting or staging a sit-in inside the An-Najah Hospital, An-Najah University, and the Israelis stormed the complex of An-Najah and detained a number of Palestinians. It's not clear how many Palestinians had been detained because the operation, Israeli forces are still raiding the city of Nablus. But we can say initially, according to the president of the university, that we are speaking about 20 to 25 Palestinians, students, of course, had been detained in the city, in the University of An-Najah. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli military raids had targeted several areas in the village of Kober. Israeli forces raided this village of Kober, and they stormed a number of houses. One of the of these houses is the house of Palestinian prisoner Nail al-Barghouti, who had been behind the bars for even over 40 years, and the Israelis conducted an arrest raid not only in Kober, in the village of Bitin, in Qalqilia, Ariha, as well as in Tulkarem.
Palestinians have conducted two retaliatory operations in different locations in the Israeli city of Ra'anana in the occupied territories. A car ramming operation and a stabbing attack killed at least one Israeli settler. 20 others have also been injured, some of them critically. Regime forces say that a car ramming suspect, who is a resident of the West Bank city of Al-Khalil, has been arrested. Tensions are mounting in the occupied territories over the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza and the regime's recurrent deadly raids against Palestinians across the West Bank. Iran has yet again issued a stern warning over the U.S.-Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. Iranian Foreign Ministry says that Washington cannot maintain its unflinching support for Israeli genocidal war while at the same time urging other countries to show restraint.
The United States cannot have full-fledged, cannot provide Israel with full-fledged support and also participate in the killing of 24,000 civilians, including thousands of women and more than 12,000 children. And at the same time, invite others to practice and exercise self-restraint and call on others to keep silent.
Amir Abdullahian advised the U.S. against tying its interest to the Israeli apartheid regime, which he says is nearing its end. He added that the U.S. is creating terrorist groups in the region, while at the same time claiming to be combating terrorism and is willing to end regional conflicts. Addressing the situation in the Red Sea, the top diplomat said that the Islamic Republic fully supports maritime security in the region. He warned the U.S. and the U.K. to immediately end the war against Yemen to prevent further escalation. He made those comments in a joint press conference with a visiting Indian foreign minister in Tehran. During the presser, the two senior officials stressed the importance of preventing the spillover of the war into the entire region.
Both of us are concerned about recent events in West Asia, which some call Middle East, and we emphasized the importance of preventing further escalation of violence and hostilities.
The top Indian diplomat called on the international community to effectively address the deeply concerning situation and the visible humanitarian crisis in Gaza. He stressed the importance of creation of a sustainable humanitarian corridor in the watered-in Palestinian territory. The Indian Foreign Minister also called for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state as the solution to end the Israeli genocide. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has staged fresh attacks on U.S. positions in both Iraq and Syria. The group confirmed that launching drone and missile attacks on three American bases, including one in the Conoco natural gas field in northeastern Syria. The resistant movement says that the strikes on American occupation troops in Iraq and Syria are in response to Washington's support for Israeli crimes against residents of Gaza. The resistance group already hit Israeli military bases across the occupied lines. The movement says that it will continue targeting the interests and bases of the U.S. until the Israeli genocide in Gaza stops. Now, on the 100th day of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, rallies have been held in several cities across Pakistan in solidarity with Palestinians. Protesters demand the International Court of Justice hold Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Similar events were held in other parts of the world, too.
In a powerful display of solidarity and condemnation, thousands of Pakistanis took to the streets in the port city of Karachi to protest against Israeli atrocities in Gaza. The protest, dubbed the Million Man March for Gaza, saw demonstrators from various walks of life voicing their anger at the Israeli regime and demanding an end to the violence that has engulfed the region for weeks.
Demands first of all ceasefire immediately, and we demand the freedom of Palestine from the river to the sea. And we demand Israel to be taken into accountability for all the crimes they have committed against the Palestinian nation.
The march witnessed massive turnouts with protesters chanting slogans to condemn the Israeli massacre in Gaza. Simultaneously, civil society activists and Palestinian students studying at Pakistani universities also held protest demonstrations in solidarity with people of Gaza, praising South Africa for taking a bold step by filing a case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The protesters called on other nations to support South Africa's initiative and urged the International Court of Justice to conduct a thorough investigation into alleged atrocities committed by Israeli forces in Gaza.
The demonstrations for Gaza highlight a widespread sentiment among Pakistanis against unwavering support from the U.S. and its Western allies for Israel's actions in the region. These marches provide a platform for Pakistanis to vocally condemn Israeli forces for their atrocities against Palestinian population. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime's ongoing genocidal assault on Palestinian civilians in Gaza is part of a long and brutal history that goes back to 1951. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, "The United States, the EU and the UK do not tire of defending the Zionist regime's genocidal war against the Palestinian people with the cliché incantation that Israel has the right to defend itself." In August 2022, the Zionist regime bombed Palestinians in Gaza over 3 days, killing 49 people, including 17 children. The U.S. and the EU's response to the massacre was to declare emphatically their support for Israel's right to defend itself and mutedly to regret the death of Palestinian civilians. That was the last major massacre the Zionist regime committed in Gaza before its current genocidal war. But it certainly was not the first. For that, we must go back to 1951, when the Zionist regime began to raid the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime had already expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to Gaza between the end of 1947 and the summer of 1950, when the remaining 2,500 Palestinians from the Mediterranean town of Majdal Asqalan were loaded on 2 trucks by the Zionist regime's army. The fabricated regime of Israel would also expel 7,000 Palestinian Bedouins to Egypt during this period up to 1955. In October 1951, the Israelis raided Gaza, killing dozens of Palestinians and Egyptians, demolishing dozens of houses and blowing up wells to curb the attempts by the expelled Palestinians to return home across new borders erected by the Jewish settler colony. Earlier in August 1949, Israeli troops captured 2 Palestinian refugees. They killed the man, and 22 troops took turns raping the woman before killing her. In March 1950, the Zionist regime troops abducted 2 Palestinian girls and 1 boy from Gaza across the new border. They killed the boy and then raped the 2 girls before killing them. By then, it was quite common for the Zionist regime troops and police to rape female Palestinian refugees attempting to return to their homes, a practice that was widespread during the Nakba a few years earlier. In August 1950, for example, 4 Zionist policemen raped a Palestinian woman picking fruit from her family's orchard across the West Bank border. The Zionist regime raids on Gaza would continue in 1952 and 1953, culminating in the Bourajji refugee camp massacre in August of that year. The Zionist regime's military unit 101 killed at least 20 Palestinian refugees, including 7 women and 5 children, by throwing bombs through the windows of their huts while they slept and shooting those who fled. Dozens were injured. Other sources put the final tally of Palestinians killed at 50. At the time, foreign observers did not mention the Zionist regime's right to defend itself and called the massacre an appalling case of deliberate mass murder. That same year, the Israelis slaughtered 70 Palestinian civilians in the West Bank village of Gibeah, which even the Indianapolis-based pro-Israel National Jewish Post compared to the Nazi massacre. In February 1955, the Israelis raided an Egyptian military camp in Gaza, killing at least 36 Egyptian troops and 2 Palestinian civilians, one of whom was a child. The Zionists bombed the Gaza city of Khan Yunis on November 2, 1956, from the air, killing scores of civilians before Zionist tanks entered the city on November 3. The Israelis rounded up resistance fighters and executed them on the spot or in their homes. Meanwhile, in the adjacent refugee camp, the Zionists rounded up all men and boys above the age of 15 in the town square. They proceeded to machine gun them, killing between 300 and 500 people, the vast majority of whom were civilians and half being 1948 refugees. They occupied Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula until they were forced out by the U.S. and the USSR in March 1957. In the past few weeks, the Zionist regime carried out massacres in Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, which the Zionist regime dubbed a dangerous combat zone after it had served as a safe zone for 1 million Palestinians who had fled northern Gaza. It included the slaughter of 30 civilians sheltering at a school from the Zionist regime's savage bombings. The relentless mass killing of Palestinians since October 7th makes the 1956 savage Israeli regime massacres seem humane in comparison. In 1967, the Zionist regime again invaded and occupied Gaza. It expelled 75,000 Palestinians from the Strip and prevented 50,000 more who were working, studying, or traveling outside Gaza when the Zionist regime invaded from returning home. It confiscated 60% of the land and all the water of the Palestinians, much of which was for the exclusive use of the Jewish colonists, who had access to 18 times the amount of water available to the indigenous Palestinians. The Jewish colonists had 85 more stolen land per capita than the Palestinian owners of the land. The fabricated regime of Israel subjected the entire Palestinian population to a racialized military occupation, during which it destroyed Gaza's economic infrastructure until 2005. Since the Zionist regime's redeployment around Gaza in September 2005 and its incarceration of 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza concentration camp, the Israelis launched numerous bombing campaigns against the camp's civilian inmates and the resistance, including in 2006, 2008 to 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021, killing thousands of civilians. The only victory that the Zionist regime's military has scored since October 7th is the slaughter of tens of thousands of civilians, with tens of thousands more injured, and more than 2 million others displaced. It has further succeeded in the destruction of homes and residential buildings, hospitals, schools, libraries, municipal buildings, churches, and mosques. Despite all the civilian slaughter and destruction, its reputation for military preparedness has been lost for the foreseeable future. As more and more details trickle out of the Zionist regime's murder of its own civilians and destruction of their homes on October 7th, it will be a long time before it can recapture some of the fictional military allure it has previously enjoyed in the West and among its Arab allies. One of the more interesting ironies of the current Zionist regime's war is that, whereas the U.S. empire and its EU and UK subsidiaries continue to rearm the Zionist regime since October 8, without respite so that the settler colony could continue its genocidal war, it is the Palestinian resistance that has had no weapons replenishment since that date and yet continues to score military victories against the Zionist regime's invaders. But not only have the Americans been the major party to this war against a colonized and brutalized people, Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor went further by identifying the United States with the Zionist regime so much that he referred to the Palestinian resistance as the enemy of the United States. Given the shameless racist discourse among Zionist regime's officials about the Palestinians as animals and subhuman, the extraordinary force of the indiscriminate Israeli killing machine and the scale of the Zionist regime's genocidal atrocities, the appropriateness or inappropriateness of the analogy is up for debate. What remains beyond doubt, however, is that while the industrial scale of Israeli regime atrocities in Gaza is unprecedented, their cruel nature has been part and parcel of the Zionist regime's war on the Palestinian people since 1948.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujja Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. And to each and every one of you as we gather tonight to commemorate the Istishhad anniversary of our 10th Imam, Imam Ali Al-Naqi Al-Hadi, alayhim afdalu salatu wa salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we each get an opportunity, inshallah, to go for the ziyarat of our imam to Samarra and that we receive his shafa'at in the hereafter, inshallah. Our imam alayhi salam is born on the 15th of Dhul Hijjah. There are two dates which are given to us with regards to the year with which our imam was born, either 212 or 214, and all that does is gives us a two-year discrepancy. But his imamat began in the year 220 after Hijrah, when his father, our ninth imam, was poisoned. And this means that he began his imamat either at the age of 6 or the age of 8. Either way, a very young age. But his father, our ninth imam, had already experienced many of the difficulties surrounding the age, as his imamat period also began at the age of 8. And so the Imam alayhi salam was the second in a row whose imamat began very early. His shahadat date is the 3rd of Rajab in the year 254 after Hijrah, which makes his age either 40 or 42, depending on which year we count for as the birth. But it also makes his period of imamat be one of the longer periods of imamat, of 34 to 36 years. And this is surprising, considering the Abbasid dynasty, what we see a trend that begins to happen from the seventh imam onwards, is that the period of imamats of our imams begin to get shorter and shorter because of the dysfunction within the Abbasids themselves. But this period of 34 years or 36 years, the Imam alayhi salam witnessed 6 different Abbasid caliphs. And of course, one of the most brutal ones that he witnessed and had to endure was the caliphate of Mutawakkil. And we've heard and talked about many of the stories of Mutawakkil. I want to focus on one of the titles of our Imam and then develop our topic from that. You know, our Imam alayhi salam is famously known as Al-Hadi. And Al-Hadi means the one who guides. And when we look at the Turath or the legacy that we have about our 10th Imam, there are many descriptions of his immense desire and care to guide people. You know, obviously all the Imams were Hadis, you know, but this is a special title that was given to him. And it shows in the way that the Imam alayhi salam dealt with people. His guidance that we still benefit till today comes in so many different ways. His speeches, his hadith, his stories that we have, his debates that he got into with many people who would try to argue about the religion, his letters that he wrote. But what's interesting is that sometimes the Imam alayhi salam, you know, would see a person who needed guidance, and it was that person themselves didn't know they needed guidance, and the Imam alayhi salam would guide them. And you know, and this is something that's really interesting, because sometimes this could be us, you know. Sometimes because of our complacency of how we do certain things, we don't realize that we are pretty much stuck in the mud, I guess you can say, right? Where I'm not progressing forward. And all we need is a little bit of guidance. And the Imam alayhi salam had that ability, that if a person, whether they recognized they needed guidance or not, he had the ability to look at that person. And if they had any light within them, he would say the right thing at the right time to have an effect on them. And we get this really beautiful incident of a person by the name of Abu Hassan al-Basri. A different Abu Hassan al-Basri, but this is Abu al-Hassan al-Basri, who is also known as al-Mallah. And he says that Dallani Abu al-Hassan wa kuntu waqifiyan, that I encountered Abu al-Hassan, which is our 10th Imam, when I used to be a Waqifi. You know, Waqifi is one of those sects that began after the 8th Imam. They believed that after the 8th Imam, there was no more Imams. So they were Waqif. They stopped at the 8th Imam. And so they were known as Waqifis. He says that I met him when I was a Waqifi. فَقَالَ لِي, and so the Imam alayhi salam said to him, إِلَىٰ كَمْ هَذِهِ النَّوْمَ, till when will you remain asleep? Yeah, subhanAllah, beautiful. Yeah, till when will you remain asleep? أَمَا لَكَ أَن تَنْتَبِهْ مِنْهَا, is it not time that you wake up from this sleep? The Imam says, and that's all he said, and he walked away. And so he says, you know what's interesting, he says, فَقَدَحَ فِي قَلْبِ شَيْئًا, something happened in my heart from that statement of the Imam, right? And he said, وَغُشِّيَ عَلَيَّ وَتَبِعْتُ الْحَقِّ, and he says, and I turned back to my heart, something affected my heart, and I woke from my unconsciousness, and I came back to Haq. We've talked about in the past that this is one of the roles of the Imams, you know? Because sometimes we hear stories like this and I think we've become jaded. Yeah, we're like, oh, mashallah, Imam said it, you know. I can say that to some of you. Wake up. It won't make a difference. You could say it to me. It won't make a difference, you know. But that's because the Imam knew who to say it to, right? The Imam knew who to say it to, when to say it, how to say it, what tone to say it to have an effect. And that is one of the statuses or one of the divine gifts that Allah gives to Imams. And this is not just the 12, but anyone who has reached that status of an Imam. So Ibrahim would be given this, our beloved Prophet would be given this, and they see the light. And if there is any light in the heart, the Imam can tap into that light, you know. And this is the remarkable quality of the guidance. And this is something that I think, you know, we desperately need to create light in our heart. Because it's not that the light, inshallah, will take us in the right direction. But man, if there is no light, there is nothing for the Imam to tap into, you know. And so it's our jobs right now, in our world that we live in, is to try and create as much light as possible, not to surround our heart in darkness. Because when the Imam comes, it's the light that will recognize the Imam, right? But this is many beautiful points that we can take from this, right? Like, it shows us, like, on one hand, the care that our 10th Imam had to guide all of creation. So he wasn't there just for the Imam of the Imams, or for the Imamis, right? For those who are Shia. But he was there as an Imam for anyone. Anyone who needed guidance, the Imam was there to provide it for them. And that shows that magnanimous nature that our Imams had. You know, further to that, we can see the that ability of the imam to say the right thing at the right time, and the versatility of how the imam's guidance would come.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matim. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Private sector activity in the Eurozone has worsened at the end of the year, raising the possibility that the region may experience a recession soon. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Financial Times has covered this story and tells us more. According to economists, lower public spending is set to curb Eurozone economic growth next year as the bloc moves into an era of budget restraint, putting pressure on rate setters to loosen monetary policy. Recently, the European Union finance ministers agreed to new fiscal rules that replace strict but hard-to-enforce budget constraints that have been suspended since the pandemic hit in 2020. The measures will phase in tighter spending curbs, forcing higher debt countries to lay out plans to decrease their debt deficit and set a ceiling on annual expenditure agreed on in Brussels. Lucretia Rachlin, a professor at London Business School and former Director General of Research at the European Central Bank, the ECB, said the new rules will still be restrictive, and for countries with high debt like Italy, that is bad news. Economists expect a jarring end to almost 3 years of supportive fiscal policy in the European bloc, as the return to more restricted government spending further squeezes weak demand and activity. The Eurozone economy contracted 0.1% in the third quarter of this year, after stagnating for most of this year. Jack Allen Reynolds, an economist at Consultants Capital Economics, said the new European Union rules would be more strict by requiring high-debt countries like Italy to cut their budget deficits faster, but also more lenient in allowing countries to reduce debt levels more slowly. Some fear the shift could even mark a return to pre-pandemic situation in which the European Central Bank had to shoulder most of the burden for economic stimulus, forcing it to resort to negative interest rates and large bond purchases to ward off deflation. Recently, the European Central Bank brought forward the timing of when it expects countries to repeal support measures that were ushered in to counter the recent jump in energy and food prices, forecasting a sharp tightening of the single currency bloc's fiscal stance in 2024. The European Central Bank forecast the overall budget deficit of the Eurozone countries would shrink from 3.1% this year to 2.8% next year. That contrasts with a much more expansionary stance in the United States, which the International Monetary Fund expects to have a budget deficit of 8.2% this year and 7.4% next year. Konstantin Veit, a portfolio manager at Investor PIMCO, said the European Central Bank may struggle to boost economic activity. Konstantin Veit said, "We might end up in a situation again where governments are not investing enough and the European Central Bank has to do more, but monetary policy ends up pushing on a string." According to Consensus Economics, economists have cut their 2024 economic growth forecasts for the euro area from 1.2% at the start of the year to just below half a percentage point. The European Central Bank recently cut its 2024 economic growth forecast to 0.8%, down from 1% previously. The average forecast for Germany's economic growth next year has fallen from almost 1.4% at the start of the year to below 0.4%. Many economists have cut their forecasts after recent court ruling, which Tomasz Wielodek at T. Rowe Price said would create a fiscal drag of 20 billion euros to 30 billion euros next year for the EU's largest economy. Martin Wolberg, an economist at Generali Investments, recently cut his forecast for Germany's economic growth next year to only 0.1%, warning the country's budget crisis will have a negative economic effect primarily by a hit on confidence. Martin Wolberg added, "Damping down euro area growth, it will, at the margin, increase the willingness of the European Central Bank to embark on an interest rate cut." Minister for Public Expenditure and President of the Eurogroup of Finance Ministers, Pascal Donohue, told reporters recently that the EU's recent rules were undoubtedly going to have an impact on the fiscal stance in the Eurozone, which he described as restrictive in 2024. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Private sector activity in the euro area worsened at the end of the year, raising the risk that the region may experience a recession soon. Standard & Poor's Global's Purchasing Managers Index contracted for a seventh month in December, falling to 47. That defied economist expectations of a slight uptick, though they still predicted that the gauge would remain well below the 50 level that marks expansion. Readings for both manufacturing and services showed a slump. Hamburg Commercial Bank chief economist Cyrus de la Rubia said, "The figures paint a disheartening picture as the Eurozone economy fails to display any distinct signs of recovery." Cyrus de la Rubia added, "The likelihood of the Eurozone being in a recession since the third quarter remains notably high." Recent numbers, which also showed that inflows of new business fell sharply, chime with indicators and data that suggest the region's contraction in the 3 months through to September saw a repeat in the final period of the year. Still, the European Central Bank's latest forecast, published recently, predicted a slight improvement in the period. similar to the overall trend. Separate purchasing managers index for Germany and France showed the downturn worsened in the euro area's two biggest economies. German bonds extended gains and the euro fell after the figures were released. Traders added to bets on European Central Bank interest rate cuts next year after the softer data, pricing 155 basis points of monetary easing. That's down from about 150 basis points on Thursday, 21st of December. Bloomberg Economics said the survey suggests the broader picture is one of an economy still contracting. That creates downside risk for our forecasts as well as the European Central Bank's forecasts and should keep market expectations for an interest rate reduction before June alive. Geopolitics, customer reluctance, and the European Central Bank's battle against inflation were cited as reasons for the subdued performance in the German economy. Standard & Poor's Global said uncertainty about the country's public finances after a landmark constitutional court ruling sparked a budget crisis may also have weighed in on economic activity. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Keeping the memory of martyrs alive, a necessary repetition for society. December 6, 2023. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the organizers of the Congress for the commemoration of the 10,000 martyrs from the East Azerbaijan province. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on December 6, 2023. Regarding those who have forgotten Almighty God, he says, Do not be like those who forget Allah, so He makes them forget their own souls. Quran chapter 59, verse 19. They forgot God, so God made them forget themselves. This shows that paying attention to oneself, one's identity, and one's own characteristics is necessary for every person, nation, and group. Azerbaijan must pay full attention to the identity that has caused it to stand out. The place we call Azerbaijan truly has an outstanding identity among the people of the Iranian nation. Azerbaijan is the birthplace of martyrs and people who have sacrificed their lives. And this is not just limited to the sacred defense. It was the same before that, and it remains the same after that. With regard to matters related to the event of the Islamic Revolution, if we are to look at it, the martyrs of Azerbaijan started from before the revolution. That is, from the beginning of Imam Khomeini and the Iranian nation's movement, the behavior leading to martyrdom and the movement toward martyrdom in Azerbaijan began and has continued up until today.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the case of the defenders of the shrines, there are martyrs from Azerbaijan. Of course, the peak of these sacrifices, the peak of showing the high value and character of Azerbaijan, was seen during the sacred defense in the figures that were mentioned, such as Martyr Mehdi Bakri, Martyr Hamid Bakri, Martyr Tajallai, and Martyr Yahchian. These were our great distinguished brothers who went to meet God. Praise God, there are other dear prominent figures like them as well today. So, this characteristic of seeking martyrdom and the outstanding behavior that was observed in their sacrifices is not limited to the imposed war.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.